Ciao, benvenuti. Welcome to Choc Tops and Cassata, the podcast that takes a peek into the way migrants got their fix of Italian movies from World War II to the advent of SBS in the early 80s.
This is a Secret Life of Language podcast from the School of Languages and Linguistics at the University of Melbourne. I'm Elisabetta Ferrari, lecturer in Italian Studies at the University of Melbourne.
I'm Mark Nichols. I research and teach in film in the School of Culture and Communications at the University of Melbourne.
And I'm Santo Cilauro. I'm not a lecturer in anything. I'm a writer, I'm a filmmaker, and an unashamed connoisseur of all Italian B-grade movies, regardless of where they were made. Sicily, Calabria, or way up north in Naples. We've had great guests on this podcast, but when it comes to the heart of what we're actually here to examine, namely the history and evolution of local movie houses screening Italian films for migrant communities, I'm sure none is as important, central, and integral than the man we're about to introduce. From very humble beginnings, he established and now heads a major distribution company as well as Australia's largest independent cinema chain, Palace Cinemas. On top of that, exactly 25 years ago, he founded the Italian Film Festival in Melbourne, which, amazingly, is the biggest public celebration of Italian cinema outside of Italy. Cavaliere Antonio Zeccola, we are delighted and honoured to be speaking with you today.
I am honoured to be with such eminent people here in this room.
Fantastic. I think this is the first time we've had a cavaliere with us.
Yes.
For those who don't understand, a cavaliere is a knight. And I can vouch for Antonio being a knight. He left his horse outside. It's just nose in a trough as we speak. Antonio, thank you so much for coming in today. I guess we should start at the beginning. The Zeccola family, when did they get here? Why did they get here?
Yeah, well, it was very simple because, we don't have that much time. In 1956, my father came here to Australia because we had an uncle of ours that was a prisoner of war. And when he came back to Italy, he said many good things about Australia, the possibility of the future, et cetera, et cetera. So my father came in 1956. We got here in 1957, October 1957, which was like 12, 18 months after he got here.
Sorry to interrupt, but your uncle, he was a prisoner of war.
Yeah, Giovanni.
Yet he said this is a great place to come to.
Yes.
That in itself is quite amazing.
He was a prisoner for 3 years. He worked in a farm, and he was an agricoltore di mestiere, and the farm was looked after, but had many things that need to be fixed up, like this beautiful peach tree that was in front of the farmhouse, but it was overgrown, was never really chopped at the right time in the right position. So what he did that at the right time, and he chopped it right back. When the family came out of the house and saw this tree, it was the nudity of everything just there. Like, they wanted to kill him. I think the father went and got a gun and wanted to shoot him because it killed the tree until spring. When spring came, it was all full of flowers and everything. They appreciated
what he did.
And he did many other things. But he also told us jokes. War jokes, and he said that it was hot, and he worked hard, and he sat down on what he thought was a tree trunk until it moved, and it was a snake.
Oh, no. It just shows the attitude of the migrants at the time. You're actually locked up in a place, things aren't going that well, people don't understand why you're chopping trees down, all that, and you're still telling your family, this is the land of dreams. I find that amazing.
He obviously eventually was loved by the family, and I was sorry when he had to go. Mm-hmm. And that's what he told us as well, because he did some really magic things in the garden. And he also did the same in Italy, a little piece of land that he had, and he really produced beautiful wines and beautiful other things in Italy.
So was your brother or your father involved in cinema back in Italy?
My father was a bit of a creative person. Before cinema, he organized theatre plays, Pirandello, in this church hall. It was always a church hall in Piazza dei Monaci, a Muro Lucano. And so he would pick up the book, a Pirandello book, for argument's sake. He would write the script, and he would get his friends to do it, and because he was a cabinet maker by trade as well, he'd do his own sets so that he would produce and run this theatre plays in this church hall. When cinema became a little bit more popular and he was able to go to Naples, buy the equipment and start showing films in this little theatre that turned into a little cinema, that's how he got into cinema. And I remember many elements when I was a kid. I would always sit in the front row. I remember Bing Crosby, The Bell of St. Mary, in Italian, of course. And I remember many other little things. As a little kid, I was there in the front row watching films all the time. Because films had to be naturally suitable for my age as well, because it was a church hall. So when in 1957 he came to Australia, 56 he came to Australia after he had been to Brazil for 3 months, and he hated Brazil, and he came back to Italy, borrowed more money, and decided to go back to Australia because of my uncle's suggestion. And in 1957, we arrived. We knew not a word of English, nothing at all. When I say we, it was me, my four brothers, my sister, and my mother. So, and my father, don't ask me why, he managed to borrow £2,200 from the Commonwealth Bank to pay for the passages because he didn't want to wait with the £10 immigration system that existed at the time. I don't know how he did it, but he did it.
And tell me, the fact that he had set up this improvised kind of cinema and theatrical shows did he have an intention to come to Australia to do that, or was that that wasn't part of the plan?
That wasn't part. See, cinemas for us for many years was a part-time situation until probably 1965 when it became a full-time, almost full-time job for some of us. But we always loved cinema, obviously. My father loved it. My elder brother, Frank, was in it as well. So when we actually started, it was like, I think I was 19 when I had my first cinema in Noble Park called the Pix Theatre, which is still there. And we started, because it closed down, I rented from the Springvale Council and rent cinemas there on Friday and Saturday. It was just a hobby. I wasn't making any money. And I had three other jobs. I was working as a biker. I was working for the Frank D'Agostino, the delicatessen shop in Noble Park, stacking things and doing home delivery. But cinema was a part-time thing. When I came back from Italy in 1976, I took over the Palace Cinema in Bourke Street. And that's when I decided to dedicate myself, drop everything that I was doing, but just go into the film business full time. Because up until then, I had done all kind of jobs, had a wife and two boys already, and therefore the cinema wasn't sufficient enough. Even the Metropolitan Cinema, which was hugely successful initially, in the 70s, early 70s, when SBS came, it sort of stopped a lot of Italians going to the cinema. And not only that, but also when we bought films, we not only bought the right, but we bought the print as well. The prints were the 35mm prints made out of silver. At that time, the silver quadrupled in prices, so the prints were very costly. And because we only had a one bite of a cherry, like we could only screen the film once at the Metropolitan, it just did not pay when you had to sort of spend £500, £600, £700 to buy a print plus another £500, £700 for the rights to screen the film, and you only screen it once. It wasn't economical, feasible. And so that's when, in 1975, we closed the Metropolitan. I think it was about that time. It was 10 years after we opened. But initially, it was just incredibly successful. But after, it wasn't. And I had to, because I wanted to stay in the business, I had to find my way into the industry the way I did.
When you bought a print, you said that I assume you were only showing it once because at that stage you only had one cinema. But yeah. Were there any restrictions on how many times you could show a print if you'd had 10 cinemas at the time?
No, but there weren't any cinemas. Like even Sydney didn't have a cinema.
Yes.
And then Five Dock, again, Frank, my brother, he opened a cinema in Five Dock. Then he went to South Australia and he opened another cinema in Adelaide. And there was one in Perth always, but they never actually returned the investment that was being made.
But it's still quite incredible to think that in the 60s and early 70s, there were various Italian cinemas in the one city and everyone was surviving.
Yes, yes. La Scala, as you mentioned, the one in Brunswick, the one in Palumbo in Clifton Hill, Cinema Italia.
Yeah. Yeah, did you ever have to get together with all the other owners just to decide not to get in the way of each other? How competitive was it?
It was very competitive. With La Scala, sometimes we used to supply them with films the week after or whatever. So there was a sort of a communication, but we also knew that they weren't doing all that well either. So it was getting a bit harder when Metropolitan opened. Because of the capacity of the Metropolitan, close to a couple of thousand seats, it sort of absorbed a lot of the business of all these other smaller cinemas had.
But it must have been slightly sort of wild frontier land because there's not really much regulation going on. It doesn't seem like there's much, so some operators can get away with buying pirated films and getting away with it.
In Naples, there was a street which is still there from off of Spacca Napoli, where they used to have pizza of films, you know, plate of films there, right, pirated, and they were there on the ground.
Who controlled all that? Was the government getting involved?
Or? No, they weren't. No, because we also were screening on Sunday or things like that, which was illegal at the time. So, you know, there was no control. We didn't exist as far as there.
Wow. I love that. I think that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. But I also wonder how much of control did you have on the kind of film that you would choose and screen? I suppose if there were films that were bought more in a, I don't know, like in a black market, you would just have to get whatever was there available. Whereas by going through Titanus, for example, you would really have a choice on what to screen.
The money that we were paying allowed us to screen as many times as we wanted to. There was no restriction. The restriction was only on the length of time, which I remember it was about 5 years that you could have had that film, which then we extended to 7, and now we buy a lot more for that. But initially, it wasn't the amount of time you screened the film. And in fact, we did screen the film many times over as a support of the main film that we had. So we had a new film, and it's also because we always screened double, okay? So we had the main film, and then we had a supporting film that had already screened before, but it wasn't. There was no restrictions as far as the amount of time you could screen it. It was more to do with the length of time that you could have screened it for.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. And so, what about the choice of films? So, who decided what film actually to buy to screen?
Look, we knew what was popular. Because we sold the tickets to the people that came. And so we knew that the Franco and Cicin Grazia were very, very popular. And then we knew that the Albano, Gianni Morandi, the musicals, you know, they were really, really successful. My brother Frank was even more successful in convincing Paramount, the American Paramount, in supplying us with the Ten Commandments in Italian, The Sting in Italian, The Godfather in Italian, you know, and was second-hand prints that came from Italy. But that really what kept us going on even more so than the Italian films, because as we talked before, some of the Italian films were popular, but others weren't. And at times you were forced if you wanted a Frankie Chichen Garcia film, you also had to get something else.
What about art house films, your Viscontis and your all those films?
That were, you know, like we had the Investigazione di un cittadino di sopra di ogni sospetto, Gian Maria Volonté, I don't know if you know the film. We had Nino Manfredi films. We had quality films, but the quality films that weren't as popular, to be honest with you, that were just that came because they were regulars, but it didn't bring the sort of crowd like, you know, sell-out crowds at Metropolitan like the Franco Chichen Garcia. At times, there was a cinema in Lathrop Street, I think, that played Italian films. And every now and then there was in Collins Street, the village, can't remember, that were playing sometimes some good Italian films. Like the, I can't remember the title, is one of Sophia Loren that was in it. And they were, it was a normal cinema. Bear in mind, in those days, cinemas were not doing as well than the English speaking cinemas. And in fact, when we were playing films like Ten Commandments in Brunswick, And we had the guy from Paramount to come and visit us on a Saturday night, and we had sold a couple of thousand tickets. He would tell us that the whole city did not sell 2,000 tickets for that particular night, and we saw them in one session. Like,
well,
that's amazing.
I mean, TV starts here in 56, and that's a problem for English language cinemas in a big way.
A lot of cinemas closed.
So at the time, the audience were mainly Italians.
Migrants, 100%.
Migrants, 100%. Yes.
A related question, were there ever Northern Italians? Because I suspect it was a heavily Southern Italian.
Yes, they were regulars, and it was fantastic. My wife, Karen, was selling tickets, and I was in Asher on a Saturday night. And it was like when someone came and bought tickets, they didn't buy one or two tickets. They bought for their grandmothers, for the wife, parents, for the six children, for that. You know, they were buying so many tickets, you know.
And the catering would have been interesting as well. We had your nephews, Carlo and Giovanni, said that the cassata was the favorite.
The cassata was just walking out. We'd get hundreds. And we never had enough, because if you have 1,000 people, you can only have on the table, stools or whatever, a couple hundred. But once again, when they came in, they didn't want one cassata, two cassata. They wanted a box full of cassatas. And so we did our best. Because we had two features all the time, there was their interval. At their interval, it was like packed everywhere. Yeah.
And just on a particular thing, the Metropolitan itself was regarded as one of the great designs of cinema with the futuristic look. By the time you had taken over, what was the decor like? Was it still the original?
Well, the decor was the same. It was famous because it was the first film in a cinema in Australia which had a revolving
stage,
And also it had the capacity, but architecturally it was left alone. But cracks started to appear at certain parts, so we had an engineer looking at it and things like that. But it wasn't.
What about the ticket box? That future
still there,
That ticket box is still there?
Was there,
because the people are trying to find out where it is. That's a real mystery.
Yeah.
Okay.
And also what my brother Frank did, he imported a fountain from...
We talked about
the mystery. You had the fountain.
Yeah, we had the fountain.
Yeah, good. That's a mystery solved, because we've talked about that a couple of times and no one can remember which cinema it was.
There's a lot of people who say that the fountain was at Cinema Italia, and as a person who went to Cinema Italia a lot, I can't remember a fountain.
We Frank specifically, my brother Frank, who took the leasehold of the building from a Greek landlord in Sydney, he bought the fountain in Italy, brought it to Australia for the Metropolitan Cinema.
With coloured lights, am I right?
Yes, they had all the, for the time, all the jingling bells and everything, spreading up and down.
That's good. That's a mystery solved.
Exactly, yeah.
Can I just ask a parallel question? For what was happening with your cinema and the other Italian cinemas in Melbourne. Was the equivalent happening with Greek cinemas?
Yes.
So it was, as popular?
Yeah, very popular, because there was the Empire Cinema a little bit further down in Sydney Road, Brunswick. Yeah. And that just closed a little bit before us.
So you pivoted after the demise of Italian cinemas. You still had the passion for Italian cinema itself. Uh-huh. And thought, okay, how do I reinvent?
Yeah.
How does the family reinvent itself? What do we do now?
Well, and that's what happened in 1976. This cinema, the Palace in Bourke Street, which had been completely renovated, and it was a beautiful, beautiful cinema and was available. The people that had bought it had gone receivership, so it was in the hand of a finance company, Lensworth Finance, I remember the name. I went to them and I begged them to let me operate the cinema for a popcorn rent, you know, and they let me have the cinema. So I reopened the cinema, but I wasn't allowed to play first release films because there was a cartel amongst the Hoyts,
yes,
owned by Fox, and the Greater Union Village owned by Rank. So it was difficult for me to get films. So I had to reinvent myself to stay in the business. And what I used to do well with was having, like, on a Sunday, the Pink Panda days, like start at 10 o'clock and run all the Peter Sellers Pink Panther films. And I used to do with Woody Allen films, and I used to do it with the Bond films. So that sort of somehow, and I used to do double features.
Not Franco and Ciccio, though.
No, double features.
Were you able to, though, to screen also Italian films, or were mainly, international American films?
At the same time, I had another cinema in Glenferrie Road in Malvern, the old Metro in Malvern. And so we used to occasionally run an Italian Sunday, but there just was not enough demand to bring fresh stuff in, and et cetera, et cetera. And there was the period when cinemas were closing weekly, basically, left, right, and center. So as soon as some cinemas were closed, like the Chelsea Cinema closed, I went there and took it till last. the Sandringham Drive-In was available. A village walked out. I went in there and did very well for a few months until the property was sold because it was too valuable. And so I went to Adelaide. And Adelaide, I did a few months in Adelaide, and then it didn't work, and I came back. So there's been a lot of this yo-yo type of thing up and down. And I can tell you that many times I would get up in the morning and look myself in the mirror and get a pain in the stomach. Because, like, I had certain expense, and I was saying to myself, today I've got to earn $2,000. How the hell am I going to do this? But it's amazing what that does to you. It gives you some grit, in the sort of how you want to move on in life. You get responsibility with the families and mortgages and things like that. People didn't know who I was in the industry. And I infiltrated myself bit by bit, bit by bit. And it's sort of, I didn't realize what was happening. In the meantime, I was going to, there was a market called Mifed in Cannes. And in Mifed, I had a 5 days of screenings and business. And I saw wonderful Hungarian films, Russian films, Italian films, some of them, and French films, of course, and Spanish films and what have you. And I liked them. I watched them and I liked them. And I thought, well, if I liked them, they could be an audience for me in Australia. These films were mainly playing in the Melbourne Film Festival and the Sydney Film Festival, and it was a cabal. It was only a certain amount of people very jealously
guarding their territory. Yeah.
And I thought, I think that maybe we could run a French film or a Spanish film at the Metro Malvern and see how it goes. And that's what we did. And we found that there were a lot of people that were watching this film, that wanted to watch outside the Melbourne Film Festival or the Sydney Film Festival. picked up a couple of French films, one of the first films that Gerard Depardieu did, and played them, and they were financially successful, if you like, you know. And therefore, it gave me that initiative to continue that. You know, I felt that while the majors were squeezing me out, I had just enough space to put my foot in to stop them closing it down. Because you have to remember that this was then an English-speaking country. And the industry was very, very controlled. Then other things happened. Like, I was buying these great films, and but no one would screen them. In order for me to play my films, I had to have my cinemas as well. So one thing drew to the other, and the other, and the other, and the other. And now, as you say, this, we are the largest independent family-owned cinema operators, and we also screen in these festivals that are so successful. So we would be the biggest French film festival in the world, and that's what I say. Anyhow. And with the Italian, we're not as big as the French, but we is still the largest Italian film festival.
It's incredible because that line from, you know, your beginning to where you are now, it comes from a love of cinema. You know, you say you look at yourself in the mirror and say, I've got to, you know, will I survive this? You must also look at yourself in the mirror and say, well, I'm glad that I've stuck with what my passion was, with what my father's passions were. And that every step of the way has created the next step.
That's right.
It sounds like you've turned every obstacle that you've encountered into a positive and say, okay, that's an obstacle. How do I get around this? And how do
I... And you are climbing the mountain.
and which brings us to today. I mean, you still run the cinemas, and cinema is in an interesting state at the moment because of, you know, what we stream. Mm. So do you enjoy the challenge of whatever the future brings, or do you fear for the future of cinema?
Actually, having gone through COVID and streamers and just coming out of it, we're not there yet. We're not back to now 2018 or 2019. We're like 25% below that, and so is the whole world, not just us. However, when we have a film that people want to see, they come in. It's harder. But in answer to your question, cinemas, having survived thus far, they will never close. I think that there's another couple hundred years of life left in the cinema. It doesn't matter what the new technologies will bring. And we've been under attack. You know, it's not just the streamers, but also the home televisions. The screens are larger, the sounds are better. And so there's a whole competitive element that competes with us. And being a confident man that I had to be confident all the time, I'm not going to give up right now. You know, I'm going to keep on fighting.
Because just when you think sort of Italian cinema is sort of dead and buried, then, you know, the last couple of years have been good for Italian cinema, haven't they?
Excellent. Yes, excellent.
There have been some great films.
And great filmmakers.
Yes.
You know, Matteo Gardone,
Sorrentino,
et cetera, et cetera.
For those who don't know, the Astor Cinema, that is an iconic cinema in Melbourne, it had its problems a few years ago.
Yes.
You stepped in, and now it's one of your cinemas.
Yes.
Can I just ask you, those decisions, how much of it in percentage terms is a financial decision, and how much is it from the heart?
Honestly, if I were to look at what I've done in my life, if my decision would have been financial, I would have been a builder.
Mm.
I would have been a developer.
Yeah, wrong business
or something.
Yeah.
But when you got to go out there and buy a film, take a sum of, say, $500,000, and you don't know whether the film is going to work or not, and you're going to put another couple hundred thousand dollars to promote the film, and with that $700,000, I can buy an apartment in a city that's going to grow in value. So... That gives you the answer?
That answers my question. Well, I've got to tell you, I have my own answer to my own question. And that is, I went to the Astor Cinema a couple of months ago to introduce a film called Pushkas and Ange.
Postecoglou.
So it was a documentary about Ferenc Pushkas, one of the great soccer players of all time, and how he met Ange Postecoglou when he coached at South Melbourne. And the cinema was packed. Top and bottom was packed. And people were screaming and shouting at the games. And to me, I was almost in tears thinking, this is a cinema.
Yeah.
Mm.
This is the sound of a cinema.
And that's the advantage we have. You can't repeat that at home.
That's right. So therefore, one of the great experiences in my life is going to see the first Gladiator at a cinema about 7 times, maybe.
Yeah.
There's nothing like it.
No. And we do, you know, like, for example, we have the certain films that we run regularly that have got that kind of elements that they come dressed up for the Blues Brothers.
And the Rocky Horror.
And the Rocky Horror Show and a few others.
Yeah. Mm. You probably didn't have the... what was the cinema where the Valhalla used to be in Richmond?
The old Valhalla.
They used to run not only Blues Brothers nights, they also used to have Ed Wood Jr. nights.
Yes.
So he's the worst filmmaker of all time. a robot monster and Plan 9 from Outer Space. And every time a UFO came on, people would throw paper plates. It was good fun.
Yes, and so then they moved to Westgarth.
That's right, yes.
And Westgarth, we took her over and we started.
In fact, I remember going to Westgarth to watch the Maradona documentary, and the feeling inside the cinema was very similar to when I watched Italy versus West Germany in 1970 at Chinatown.
But this idea of and which I think we've all experienced in different contexts, of going to the cinema not just to see the film but to experience community, and that must go back to the old Brunswick days. I mean, that the double feature, the casate, the families coming in for, you know, is that your feeling?
It is, it went more than that as well, because, for example, when we opened the Carmel and even the George in St. Kilda, we introduced the coffee machine. Before, you couldn't get espresso, the cappuccino. soon after, we introduced panettone. Like in most cinemas, you can have a cappuccino and panettone, or you can have a prosecco and panettone. Now, prosecco, for example... We had a sponsorship deal with Brown Brothers, who produced the Prosecco. Prosecco is a special drink that comes from a specific part of Italy in the north, and it was not known out there in the market. It was just the Italians. Not even being from the south, I wasn't all that familiar with the Prosecco like the northern Italians were. So we made a deal with these winemakers. And when we had Italian film festivals, they produced for us a few thousands piccolo proseccos, which we had in the gift bag of the Italian film festival, and which we eventually, as a contra deal, we were selling as well by the glass. You know. Now, I don't want to claim there are other things that have happened marketing-wise, but I think that the Italian film festival launching Prosecco and the screen ads and what have you made Prosecco what it is today.
Wow, that's amazing. I never even thought of that.
Yeah? Now we just need to reintroduce the cassata. interesting what Mark was saying. You know, even the film festival, I think the language film festival recreated that sense of community and participation of a gathering of people at the cinema.
If I may say also with the panettone, now, you would remember that panettone was not available in supermarkets and in places like that. So we introduced the panettone, and even chemists are selling panettone. So that was another element of the Italian.
They were going in for Panadol and coming up with panettone.
I mean, I think the thing is you can go to any one of the screenings for the Italian, which is the one that we go to, the film festival, and there is that sense of community, which is I noticed the most the year we were streaming because of COVID, and I'm sitting there in my little room watching my films, and it was great that I could see them, but it didn't have the experience that I look forward to. The idea of people coming back for multiple screenings.
Just before we go, we've had a great time. Just before you, what was your favourite film that you've ever shown? And it has to be pre-Palace days. I'm talking at the Metropolitan, when we're talking about Italian cinemas. What was your favourite film? The one that you would look at and say, I love this.
You know... I do get asked that question because there's a number of them. Mm.
You can embarrass yourself. It can be pretty low rent because I can tell you mine are pretty low rent.
It is a pre-Palace, you say.
Yes, I'm talking about the Metropolitan.
The Metropolitan. Well, it would have been the Albano films, for argument's sake, because with Romina Power and Albano and the IHDL Awards, the songs. And then we brought Albano to Australia.
Yes. Yes.
And so for me, that was a really special, it wasn't the most artistic time of my life.
But you enjoyed those. Yeah.
It really convinced me to continue with the work that I was doing because it was good, you know, the satisfaction. And that's pinnacle that you get, you know, sometimes with a simple film like Nel Sole, I think, was the film. And it was just a simple story of love between Albano and Romina, which they eventually got married with Franco Franca teaching us. An enormous amount of beautiful songs that were very popular at the time. Mm. And I was very proud to have that in Australia for the Italian audience.
Mm. That's great. And so, Santo, which one was your film now?
Unfortunately, it always goes back to Italy versus West Germany, semi-final 1974.
Well,
Italy wins 4-3 in extra time, so I'm afraid.
Sorry
to give away the ending. Spoiler alert. Antonio, thank you so much for not only for joining us today, but thank you so much for all these wonderful years, these decades that you've dedicated to not only Italian cinema, but all cinema, and your contribution to the landscape in this city and this country. So we thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. I hope to continue.
You have been listening to Chop Tops and Cassata, an episode of The Secret Life of Language. Special thanks to our guest, Antonio Zeccola, and our producer and editor, Alice Garner. The Secret Life of Language is recorded and mixed at the Howard Recording Studio by Gavin Nabel. It is a podcast from the School of Languages and Linguistics at the University of Melbourne. Chop Tops and Cassata would not be possible without the support of the Australasian Centre for Italian Studies. Be sure to keep up with every episode of The Secret Life of Language by following us on the Apple Podcast app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. The Secret Life of Language is licensed under Creative Commons.